Well, good evenings, ladies and gentlemen. And I was very, very keen to be talking to Keggy on this one. Keggy is an old friend of mine and a neighbour. And, you know, when neighbours say they're working on books and it's taking a lot of time, then it gets, you know, you kind of sort of wonder what the end product's going to be, and you're absolutely desperately hoping that it's going to be something that's fabulous and that you can infuse about, because I'm not very good at lying, and if I'm not genuine, it's usually pretty transparent. But I've got to say, this book is absolutely, it's completely transformative. It's an incredibly powerful piece of work. It's by turns tragic, funny, exasperating in the sense of what we've done and what humans are guilty of, but it's also full of absolute wonderment, and actually there's a wistfulness to it, because ultimately we haven't behaved very well over the last 12,000 years to the animals that we cohabit this amazing world with. But there is also that sense of incredible wonderment at what animals can do and how underappreciated they are, and sort of just one story after another, which just makes you think, gosh, I had no idea. And I ended up sort of feeling completely sort of ignorant about so much stuff. But also, it has definitely changed my life. I mean, I now eat differently after reading this book. I think it's an absolutely monumental piece of work, and it is absolutely my total, absolute belief that every single person on this planet should read it. I really, really strongly believe that. I mean, I don't know quite how we're going to sort of get through this in the next sort of hour or whatever, because there's so much to talk about, but Keggy's given us a sort of vague structure, which is that, having now introduced her, she's now going to talk for about 10 minutes or so, because she's got some nice pictures that she wants to show. And then we're just going to sort of chew the cud and talk through some things, because I've got all sorts of things that I want to ask her.
Yeah.
So that's how we're going to play it.
Yeah, and then we're going to have questions. And just before questions, I'm going to do a short reading of something that happened less than 5 minutes bird flight from here. Less 2 minutes
bird flight. And trust me, you're going to love it. It's the most amazing story that happened here in the Chalk Valley.
Okay, so he hasn't told me how to use this, but I think next means next.
There it is.
Okay.
Simona Cossack.
Okay, yeah. So this is going to be a 10-minute, just a little introduction of Beastly. So Beastly tracks the 40,000-year story of our changing kinship with the animal world. And a lot happens as we follow our wilder hearts on the road to civilization and way beyond with our godlike technology. And so why? Worry. Climate change, pandemics, fires, floods, deforestation, soil degradation, pandemics, insect collapse, pollution. We were in trouble and we were being told, but we weren't listening. So wherever I looked, all roads led back to the same thing, our relationship with the planet's other inhabitants and the removal of their homes, their food, their prospects. And then I was sent this photograph. A ball, center stage, with a girl in a dining room crowded with clocks and brass lamps. A girl scatters breadcrumbs from a loaf of bread. A candelabra is precariously alight. The time is 12 o'clock. It is like a fairy story. The dramatic quality is outlandish, yet somehow entirely natural. One is spying through a private keyhole, yet beholding a theatrical stage set. Intimate, yet inscrutable. I stared and I stared. I clicked on the link. The same girl, crouched in a forest clearing with a raven on her knee, the sun slicking the black feathers, the same girl walking through a snowy forest with a young band of deer. And there's something very powerful about the relationships going on. So It was like a spell, and I couldn't turn back. And 2 years later, I was there, my face baffled against a glass pane in a deserted lodge deep in the heart of the Poland's Bielowieża forest, peering into the very room. So this was the home of Simona Kossak, the zoologist who studied the wild animals that lived in the forest around her. She isn't a girl, she's 27 years old. The year is 1971. She wanted to live alone. The wildlife photographer, Lech Vilcek, also wanted to live alone. He was from Warsaw, and they ended up renting each side of this forest lodge, deep 6 miles up the track, right in the heart of Bielowieża Forest. So no electricity, no water, a well in the garden. And they both thought the other wouldn't last the winter. And you will have guessed, they become life partners. So began one of those rare times when everything comes fleetingly together. Two people living in harmony with the forest, the rhythms of the seasons, the animals, the deer, a fox, a stork, their chickens, a boar, a raven, a host of injured and orphaned creatures brought to their door. And so the forest lodge was part home, part hospital, part observational laboratory. Now, the evolutionary biologist E.O. Wilson uses the word biophilia, which means love of life, to describe what he believed is our deep connection with the natural world. And that's like an innate affinity that's rooted in our past, from our deep evolutionary past, when we were more intimately entwined. So here was my lodestone for what would become Beastly, this paradoxical and complicated story of animals and us. Because of all the contradictions, no other animal so eagerly forms attachments, such deep attachments across the species divide. So my envoys to tell this story are varied and many. Here's Konrad Lorenz, the Austrian zoologist who became a goose. Well, surrogate mother to three goslings he hatched in an incubator. And he began to bond by speaking to them in their eggs, much as their real mother would. Before they hatched, they began to answer. And when they broke out of their shell, he was the first thing they saw, and so they bonded with him. And they attached themselves as he was their parent, the phenomena is called imprinting, which is the thing that he is best known for. So he is one of the first early naturalists, field naturalists, who began to study animal behaviours out of the lab and in relation to their actual natural environment. And like the big game hunter Billy Arjan Singh, who became a conservationist and devoted his life to saving the big cats of India, who he used to shoot. And then it starts from our mammoth hunting days, 30,000 years ago, when humans began to change the face of the planet. So by overhunting the mammoth, we put paid to a whole ecosystem. The fertile grasslands of the steppe that stretched from France to Alaska. So mammoths with long pregnancies and few offspring cannot replace themselves in time if they're hunted. So without the mammoths grazing and dispersing seeds and nutrients, the grasslands became dominated by a tundra vegetation, which uneaten became waterlogged and frozen and turned to acid peat, and where the grasses struggled to grow. So this particular photograph I love, because the Victorians have put the tusks in the wrong way round. They go towards each other, because they were used as snow plows to open up the snow to get to the grass to eat it, and also so that the other animals came behind the all the other prehistoric animals that lived in those in that time, like the bison and the horses and the elks, they would follow the bison and be able to graze afterwards. So, animals are the best environmental fix out there. They maintain ecosystems that give us oxygen, food, clean water, while taking the carbon dioxide away for free. They replenish the nutrients, engineer the hydrology, build the soil, clean the water, fertilize both land and sea, which is why our relationship with them is the most important on the planet, from the smallest microbe to the largest animal that ever lived, because only with their presence can ecosystems function, and with their absence they do fall apart. So sperm whale defecates 50 tons of iron every year in the upper layer of the ocean, where this fertilizes phytoplankton, which captures as much CO2 as terrestrial plants, provides half our oxygen, and feeds the krill, who feed the bigger fish, who feed the bigger fish. Whales increase marine life. So the body of a great whale, when it goes to the bottom of the ocean, takes 33 tons of carbon with it, and there it stays for centuries and centuries. So what is her ecological impact, or the impact of her loss? Over 90 years, producing, say, 10 young, who produce 10 young, who produce 10 young. So before whaling, when their populations were in their millions, their effect would have been phenomenal. Herbivores graze open glades, aerate the soil, dam rivers, transport seeds, and scatter dung. Predators keep them in check from overgrazing. So it has been estimated that healthy populations of just 9 key groups of animals, sharks, wolves, otters, oxen, wildebeest, fish, bison, elephants, and whales, could facilitate the additional capture of 6.4 gigatons of carbon dioxide each year. So that is almost the amount calculated to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees. And let me say, so I'm getting really wild up here, but let me say, there is no technology at scale that can do what animals have been doing for millennia. So this wild world has had to move over. Yet it is the wild world that maintains the ecosystems on which we rely. At school, we were taught the names of Henry VIII's 6 wives, and not the animals who lived in the bush outside our window or in the soil beneath our feet. And what more wonder could we want? What alien could change shape, colour, regenerate legs that can think for themselves, mimic the surroundings, fake seaweed, grow horns, pop up warts, glow in the dark, pour themselves down the sink, play, dance, squirt you with ink, take off by jet propulsion, and taste you all over with their embrace? If we knew animals better, we might value them not just for their services to the ecosystems, but for the intrinsic value of their individual and mysterious selves. So, it turns out, the photograph is a parable. The clocks tick. Time is running out. The mighty boar and the girl break bread. Our home is shared. Our sustenance is shared. Life supports life. Variety and abundance are our strengths. Animals could save us. The paradox is, now only we can save them. That's it. My 10 minutes.
But Keggy, but, I mean, but. Right from no buts at all, really. I know I'm just sort of thinking about it. But from the first language, whenever that was, ancient Sumerians or whatever, you know, we've been dictating in culture, haven't we, how we view animals, and very often it's a completely misconstrued. It's completely mistaken how we view animals.
Well, I mean, it is an astonishing feat to keep our knowledge of the natural world in the Dark Ages, century after century. I mean, it amazes me that Aristotle, in 350 BC, discovered the sperm-presenting arm of the octopus. He had a packet of sperm and he presented it to the female octopus. And Aristotle described this, yet 2,000 years later, in 1607, Edward Topsell, clergyman, in his History of Four-Footed Beasts, divided animals into three categories: tame and wild, inedible and edible, useful and useless. And that's where we got to. I mean, it is incredible. But we have used animals as allegories for good and evil. So
yes.
So the devil has always had animal hair, an animal tail, hooves, horns.
Yep.
You know, we talk about animals, we slander animals. I mean, if I say bitch, pig, snake in the grass, you know, why do we do that? Why do we do that? There's nothing wrong with any of those animals. We slander them, we blame them. Vermin, pest,
yes.
Scavenger.
You rat.
Rat. You know, it goes
What's
on.
Wrong
it's,
with a rat?
It's, well, there's quite a bit wrong with a rat when there's too many rats because we've taken the balance out of our whole system. So, you know, the rat's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger because it's got space to, and it's going to get into those niches that other creatures might be living in harmony until we messed up the pie. But
you take the raven, the picture of Simona Cossack with the raven. You know, we think of ravens as sort of harbingers of death. You know, they're sort of croaking on the battlefield and plucking out eyes and being sort of, you know, you think of them as sort of dark and sort of gruesome and kind of threatening somehow.
Yeah. Well, the wolf, the slander of the wolf came.
The slander of the wolf is amazing, isn't it?
The wolf came. I mean, the wolf is going to eat, you know, steal your children, eat your grandmother.
Yeah.
That they're on all the sacred texts. They're bouncing off all the churches. It's fascinating that the word for wolf in Latin, the word for whore in Latin, is lupa, and the word for wolf is also lupa. So that is, you know, it's not surprising. It's not surprising that this is how we think of animals when, you know, they have been used in this way to facilitate the way we want to use them and the way we think about them. So,
but I mean, one of the things that sort of really comes across from the book is just that animals are just so much smarter than we've given them credit for. We think that we're the smartest because, you know, we've got language and we can use our hands and you know, make all this. But that doesn't mean to say that an animal doesn't have feelings, doesn't have fears or affection or you know, all sorts of other emotions.
No, well, I mean, for centuries and centuries, animals were clueless. They had no feelings and they didn't even have consciousness. And, you know, the problem was that it was more to do with our questions about the way we questioned how they were rather than how they were. So they suffered from having to prove themselves in human ways. But they are, yeah, I mean, I've got some wonderful stories about how intelligent animals are and how they surprise us still. I mean, there's a wonderful story about Kelly the dolphin.
Tell that one.
Kelly the dolphin. Okay, so Kelly the dolphin would get her, she was in an aquarium, and she would be given a reward at the end of the day when she went around the pool and collected all the programs, the fish, anything for, I mean, fish, the programs, cameras, paper cups, bits of paper, whatever. She got a fish for whatever bit of trash that she found in her pond, in her pool. And So then she started finding lots and lots of little tiny bits of paper, because whatever trash she got, she got a fish. So it was the same reward for whatever she gave her trainer. So she started finding lots and lots of little bits of paper, for which she got lots and lots of little fish. And then when they did maintenance in the pool, they found under a rock a whole stash of programs. She had been banking her fish supply by rationing humans and tearing up these programs and giving the humans little bits. But Kelly was about to hit the big time because one day a gull flew in and drowned in her aquarium pool, and she gave it to her trainer, and her trainer gave her three fish. She never had three fish before. So she ate two and put one under her rock. And with that one fish, she lured another gull into the pool, got it, and gave it to her trainer and got three more fish. Now, she taught her calf how to do this, and the calf taught other calves, and gull baiting in this aquarium caught on. And that's a true story. I mean, there's many, many stories about how brilliant. I mean, satin bower birds, they don't just make the fantastic bowers that they make, that Western explorers thought had been made by the primitive forest people of the area of Borneo. But the Borneo polygamous men knew, they understood these structures immediately because they could see that they were the bride price, that you had to impress the bride. So they understood the animal much better than Western explorers did. But the satin bower bird not only chews up berries to pigment his bower, he actually makes a sponge out of plant fibre to suck it up and dab it on. It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, that's amazing. Know? And what about sardine shells?
Sardine shells. You think sardines, you know, they're in their silver armour and glug, glug, glug.
Put them in
glug.
A tin.
Put them in a tin and glug, glug, glug. They, go do what all the others are doing. But they have terns. They have turns on the outside because the outside is the most dangerous bit, so they swap. And they send scouts out for predators, and they can tell whether the predator's in hunting mode, and they come back with that information and that they react to it. I have a lovely story about Conrad Lorenz, who you saw...
With the geese.
With the geese, right. So he, one of his most sort of dynamic experiences learning about animals was coming back late one night and feeding his cichlid fish late. So cichlid fish are a dual African freshwater fish that are very, very good parenting skills. So the parents, they lay their fry, they have a little nesting hollow, and the mother sits with the fry, and the father, as they have a swim bladder, which they inflate, and they start to swim, and the father takes them round, and then he brings them back each night by inhaling them and putting them into their nest. They conflate their swim bladders, and they sit in the nest with the mother. Well, Conrad Lorenz came home late one night, and he hadn't fed them. And so he put a chopped up worm into the aquarium. And so the father cichlid fish, swooped on the worm, swallowed up, started chewing like this. And then one of his errant young fry swam past, and he swooped on that automatically because it was his job to take it home. And suddenly he had a mouth full of, one side he had chopped worm, and the other side he had his baby fish. And he stopped. This fish just stopped like that. And Conrad Lorenz was absolutely riveted because he could see the fish was thinking, like, hang on a minute, I'm confused. I'm chewing my worm, and I'm supposed to be taking this baby home to the mum. He stopped, and Conrad Lorenz said, "I saw that fish think. I saw that fish think." The fish stopped. He blew out both worm and fry. The fry, with its swim bladder, went to the bottom. It had conflated. Went to the bottom. The father went to the worm, chewed up, the chewed up worm, gobbled that up, chewed it up, and then when he swallowed it, he inhaled his baby and then took him to the nest. So that tiny tropical fish made a decision. And at that time, you know, they were a long way from being, I mean, I think the Cambridge Declaration of Animal Consciousness did not include fish. That was like 80 years before that even happened. So there we go.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. The other thing I find absolutely staggering is that, you know, sharks are seen as sort of, you know, terrible predators, and they've got sort of razor sharp teeth, and we just think of Jaws and that movie, and you know, they're absolutely one of the most feared beasts around, and all the rest of it. But how many people do you think get killed by sharks every year? I mean, it's literally a dozen globally.
Yeah.
And then how many sharks do you think get killed by humans every year?
Yeah.
100 million?
Yeah, it's 100 million.
100 million.
Yeah.
It's absolutely staggering.
Yeah.
And most of that is bycatch.
Yeah.
So we should talk about bycatch.
Well, bycatch is a very little word, isn't it, for a very, very big thing. You know, it's a very, very big thing. I mean, the oceans is one of our real problems that we've been taking, and we don't put anything back. And bycatch is just a complete disaster. The little vaquita dolphin, there's about 10 left, and they are... I should start talking about sea cucumbers. Sea cucumbers are an animal. But there's a soup, a Chinese soup called Buddha Jumps Over the Wall. It costs $500. And there's five magic marine ingredients. One of them is the swim bladder of the Tatoba fish, of which bycatch sweeps up the vaquita dolphin in the Mexican Gulf. And there's about 10 or 12 of them left. Actually, I don't think they're probably more than a couple left, even if there are any left now. But, you know, this soup is really a snake oil soup of the, you know, it's called sea cucumber, which tastes pretty much nothing. These swim bladders, and it's just a complete disaster. I mean, it's just a complete disaster. So,
I mean, the thing that I found absolutely amazing was the story of the Greenland shark. Whoever knew, you know, this is the oldest living vertebrate in the world. I mean, 500 years, 400 years old.
They thought 200, and then the Greenland shark gets swooped up in bycatch. And imagine being the scientist that's dissecting this fish and then discovering it's 400 years old, that it was swimming around when the Mayflower was...
When the Pilgrim Fathers were setting
off. Was sailing towards America. That very shark was in the sea.
400-year-old shark has ended its life as bycatch, as a product, as something that's not even wanted. I mean,
they grow 1 centimeter a year, and they are not sexually mature until they're 150 years old.
That's just amazing.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, the other thing about this book was, what a beautiful, extraordinary, phenomenal, mind-blowing world we live in. I mean, for goodness sake, what a world. And we really, really need to understand it, because it's so much more interesting than half the things that we spend our time doing.
Well, yes, and then you've got the Ming clam.
The Ming clam, Ming.
Whoever knew? I mean, it's just...
Well, whoever knew? I tell you who didn't know was Bangor University, because Ming clam, a clam got dredged up again from, you know, in the dredges, in the fishing thing, and was sent off to Bangor University. And unfortunately, they did not think to count the rings on the actual shell. They counted the rings on the hinge, which to do, they had to open the clam and kill her or him. They couldn't tell which sex he or she was by then, because she was so old. 507 years old, she was. Imagine that.
Born in 1499.
Imagine that, 1499, yeah. So she's the oldest sort of... There are older organisms, pyriforms, that are joined together that just don't ever die, because they're sort of constantly, you know, linking together with new organisms. But she was the oldest, he was the oldest clam, so 507, yeah.
Well, I mean, you talk about bycatch. My son Ned was on a fishing trip. He was making a film about seals, and he was on a fishing trip with some fishermen off Newquay, and they've got all the kind of sort of ecological, kind of environmentally friendly badges you could possibly hope for if you're a fisherman in Cornwall. And in the cabin, they had a chart with all the score of all the seals they'd killed, because, of course, the seals are competing with them for the fish. And during the bycatch, they caught a shark that was pregnant, which they then killed, and then they put all the babies in a bait box.
Yeah.
And threw their pot noodles into the sea.
Yeah.
And they're environmentally friendly fishermen.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it's an enormous, enormous task. But, you know, we need to turn the boat around, because one of the things that I feel really strongly about is the sort of message that animals... they are the maintenance crew. They manage these ecosystems.
Well, they do incredible good, don't they?
Yeah.
I mean, let's talk about beavers. So what the beavers can do.
Yeah.
I mean, they're absolutely astonishing, aren't they? And those beavers in North America that you wrote about, and that amazing community that they kept and then was lost.
Well, you know, I mean, they pretty much wiped out the beavers in the beaver trade.
Top hats.
The top, yeah. I mean, you know, you can read about it in the book, and I'm not gonna. But it's fascinating. It is fascinating what, you know, what they were.
But talk about the tell us about the sort of ecosystem that they developed through their damming and through the work that they do.
Okay, so what they do is that they create these extraordinary. Ecosystems by damming ponds, creating holding water, turning land into sponges that hold huge amounts of water, and they cut down trees that regenerate very, very quickly, and so they make ponds that later turn to beaver meadows. And if you look at some of the maps of North America in you know, the 1800s, they were like this incredible just river networks of ponds and rivers.
Yes, if you'd had Google Earth in 1800, you'd just see all these little tentacles of dammed rivers, wouldn't you, all over the place.
But they were fished out, and the rivers and everything dried out, and then suddenly the land turned into sort of dust and fire. The terrible forest became completely vulnerable to these huge bushfires, and suddenly their whole ecosystem was destroyed, you know. So their comeback is making an enormous difference to flood defences and keeping the hydrology of the land, but it also creates these amazing ecosystems for other creatures, and they are almost the most valuable animal on land that you can imagine. You know, whales would be the most valuable on the sea, and beavers on the land. But the one thing, I mean, I lie at night sometimes thinking of this place. A Frenchman, Jean Thie, I don't know how you pronounce that in French, he was studying permafrost. The permafrost release on Google Earth, and he saw this strange shape in northern Alberta, in the middle of this forest. It's about 200 miles from the nearest town, and he went, "Oh, that's a beaver dam. It's like over half a mile long," and the BBC found out about it. He wrote about it on his blog. The BBC found about it, and they went to this place called it's in Buffalo Park. It's Buffalo Park. I can't remember exactly what the name is. It's a big long American name. It's in northern Alberta, and they said, "Oh, we'd really like to go and see this huge beaver dam you've got." And they didn't know they'd even had it. They didn't know they had it because it was so far away from anywhere. And they sent a biplane out there, and they couldn't land. They couldn't land because it was just swamp. It was too shallow. There was too many trees. It was too far. They couldn't walk in because it was like 188 miles. It was a place where we couldn't go. It was a place where the beavers could be the beavers, and they could make their thing and do their thing and make that, and nobody could get them. And oh my God, I just love this so much. And I just zoomed in on Google Earth. I saw the beaver dam and the place where they were working here. And they've been working for years and years and years, decades and decades and decades. And it's this sort of alluvial plain through the forest, and it's a beautiful thing.
But by 1800, you've got this sort of, you know, we were talking earlier on about the effect of language and how we sort of view animals, and there was this sort of, for the most part, a sort of disregard and that classification that you were talking about at the beginning. But really, it's the advent of the industrial age that causes all the problems, isn't it? It's actually in the first instance, it's the white man, his expansionism, yeah. His industrialization, his greed. And we've not had that check since.
Well, you know, I
we have to an extent, but not enough.
No, I mean, you know, we've had a 12,000-year war against nature. You know, it's lasted 12,000 years. From the moment we became farmers, the moment we settled, we domesticated animals, we made them fatter, woollier, whatever. And then we had to protect them because we corralled them into these sort of warm living larders, and then we had to protect them, and then we had a whole lot of enemies because there were a whole lot of insects and a whole lot of big predators like lions in the Levant coming along and eating them. And so we suddenly had enemies and we had a war on our hands. And that war has been going on a long time.
But where it's got completely out of control is in the last 200 years.
Where it got seriously out of control was when we moved into the cities and we took our natural fertilizer with us, so we ate all the crops and we didn't bring it back. So we were in the shit, so we basically went off and we dug up the battlefields and we emptied the catacombs and we ground up the bones and we shoved that all over the crops, and then we went off to the guano islands and we cleaned
yes.
them out, and then we went, oh Lord, but luckily...
Well, just tell that story about the guano islands.
Well, the guano islands were there, like they had been, they were in this extraordinary place in Peru where these huge anchovy shoals came around. It was where Humboldt, where Andrea Wolf discovered, you know, that, I mean, her hero Humboldt.
This is Andrea Wolf.
He discovered that this was this incredible rich area, this sea area, where all the currents mixed. The fish came round, and there's this huge population of seabirds that ate the anchovies that shat all over these islands, and the guano was like meters and meters and meters and meters thick. And then they got all these indentured Chinese to dig it out. Half of them died. And that came back to Europe. You know, it's a very sort of colonial thing. And that came back and fertilized our land. And then it ran out, of course, as it everything does, finite planet, it runs out eventually. And suddenly we were back again. And in fact, the Americans did this brilliant thing, like saying, oh, just go and grab any island that you can that's got guano on it and just claim it for America. It was brilliant. So there's a whole load of claimed islands that actually become nuclear testing grounds. Oh, my God, I could go on. This is what this book is about. And then... Fritz Haber magics fertilizer out of thin air. So he manages to work out how, you know, actually it's got a lot of energy and he gets nitrogen out of the air. And that is the detonator for the human population to explode. And it is also the consequence on animal history too. Because the human...
Artificial fertilizer...
It's run that pressure. It also we're also creating explosives, which you know all about. So it is at the time 1909. By 1920, we were making huge amounts, so we could feed. We could go on feeding. So more people, more crops, more chemicals. So now we're at a stage where we are just absolutely reliant on chemicals. There is more. Insecticide, 22 times more insecticide in human breast milk than in cow's milk. Yes, that's where we are.
I mean, it's an absolute staggering statistic,
and chemicals. And the trouble is, you know, we're now, it's leaching into the soil. We've got, you know, you look at our beautiful winterbourn, and it's full of algae because there's so much fertilizer in the air.
And that's before you add sewage spills, of course.
Yeah.
So you know, it's just it's It is.
But it is a fascinating story. Yes, it is. But it's,
but there are. It's, but it's not it's, all depressing.
No, it's not, because it's fascinating, because it's really depressing. And I really, really think everybody needs to know these stories, because it's so important, and there is so much we can do if we just flip the thing and understand about animals, because nature comes back very, very quickly. It comes back really quickly if we let it, you know. Like in Chile, they are doing these smart acoustic buoys to alert shipping where the whales are. I mean, that's a beautiful thing. That's the first nation-led, it's a world first.
So how does that work? Explain how that works.
Well, it tells the shipping to move. There's whales there. Go round this way.
Right.
Yeah, so don't drive into them. Because whales are coming back, you know, after whaling, after the millions and millions of whales we used to have and wipe them all out, they're coming back. There are blue whales sighted with calves near Georgia in the Antarctic Sea.
So I saw one last winter.
Yeah, it's a very beautiful thing, you know. And so what we have to do is just facilitate that. We have to facilitate that. And this is why the sort of the thing on technology will save us is frustration, because we have the technologists, we have the engineers, they're called beavers and whales and all sorts of things that make this world beautiful. It makes this
and
world
rock oysters
beautiful.
That filter water.
That's a
I mean, rock
thing.
Oysters are amazing. The whole of the sort of west coast of Scotland
That's
is obviously
thing.
Covered in rock oysters. And they can filter something like 80 litres of water
a
day, a single rock oyster.
Yeah.
So the waters 150 years ago off the coast of Scotland would have been crystal clear.
Yeah.
And they've all been dredged.
Yeah. But they're coming back because
tens and hundreds of millions
humans
of them.
Are bringing them back, and humans are really doing brilliant things with oysters, and they're doing brilliant things with mussels. They're doing oysters in New York. So, yep. You know, and then, you know, breakfast, okay. But breakfast as well, you get that out of these
ones. And the
things.
Tortoises on Galapagos?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's one of my favourite stories. And in fact, there's a picture. There's a picture. So, the beautiful, beautiful story of... In 1960, in Española, these Galapagos Española giant tortoises were down to 15 individuals due to feral goats just totally decimating their habitat. So they took the 15 individuals off and they put them in a 55-year breeding program, 55 years. And they eradicated the goats, and the breeding program has now returned about 2,300 at last count giant tortoises back to that island, and they are absolutely thriving. But get this, oh my God, in 2020, 15 humans... got the 15 surviving, they've all survived, the original adults that saved their species from extinction. And they put them on a tractor trailer, put them on a boat, and they backpacked them like giant Stone Age coracles to the interior of their island, let them go for these tortoises to live out their long lives with their family. And I think that is one of the most beautiful things. And that is how we can help nature come back. So the whole tortoises, these giant tortoises create habitats for a whole host of other animals that, because of the way they graze, is not like the goats kind of completely strip out because the goats were an invasive species. And it's a very beautiful thing. And this is what we need to be doing now. And it would be a joy. So.
And there are people around the country. I mean, you know, there's quite a lot of talk now about regenerative farming, and there's
more
and more people every year are taking to that, this idea that you don't kill anything, that you just create life. And what a lovely thought that is. You know, there's people looking at the Caledonian forest, aren't they, and really trying to grow that back again, and there's people doing the environments for more rock oysters or whatever it might be. But the fact remains that when you buy your chicken from Nando's or a fast food store, or frankly a chicken thigh in Marks and Spencer's, the chances are that's probably only been alive for 33 days. And you know, anyone who's had a chicken from wild will know that a chicken takes 147 days to get to point of lay, and it still doesn't look that plump at that point. It's pretty immature. So if you're eating a 33-day chicken, just imagine what's been put into that to enable that to be a fully fledged, wrapped up chicken in Tesco. I mean, it's just absolutely disgusting. And then we're all eating that, which is presumably where all the, that's one of the reasons why you're having sort of dodgy breast milk and stuff. I mean, it's all absolutely, it's absolutely revolting. Or the bacon that oozes sort of white gunk because it's been pumped full of water and never sees any daylight.
There's a lot of problems because we've got an antibiotic problem with the amount of antibiotics, because they are literally petri dishes waiting to sort of bloom into pandemics, these industrial livestock farm systems. But there's another problem, and there are a million sort of practical problems about industrial livestock feeding and or eating, which just go on and on and on. But there's another problem, and that is it's cruel. Like, it's seriously cruel, and it's an evil thing to keep a pig in a cage while it's having a baby and not letting it fulfill its natural life urges, its relationships. It's absolutely cruel, and we shouldn't do
it. I mean, you wouldn't do that
it.
To a pet dog, would you?
You wouldn't do it to anything that you knew. And the problem is we don't know them, and it's all behind biosecurity doors, and it's all behind a whole load of lies and labelling that's not right. And
well, it's like Stalin, isn't it? You know, one death is a tragedy, a million is a statistic. Yes. It's the kind of the same the same approach.
Yes.
You know, what you
yes.
don't know, you don't care about. So
no.
I'll go back to Nando,
no.
thank you.
And I have to say, you know, it's a hard subject to write about, and a lot of people throughout writing and also since writing do this. They don't want to know. But we do need to know. We do need to know, because we need to change it. And the other thing about it is, and I'm going to do a little reading, which is a nice
positive
thing.
Do your magical story.
I'll do a
end
little
on a
reading.
Good note.
I'm going to end on a good note, because there is so much joy, and you can flip it around really, really quickly and easily.
Well,
and
this
nature
is the point, is
back.
Is that once we start to engage with nature, our lives are enriched.
Yeah,
they
absolutely.
Are. You know, you get called a twitcher if you're interested in birds and watch birds.
No, but it's fascinating.
It is fascinating.
It's
and what
fascinating.
Joy there is to behold by listening to the first chiff-chaff when it arrives in March, or seeing the first... So it, it enriches your life.
And
you
the more you know, the more
it.
Interesting it is.
Exactly.
And the more, you know, and there is an enormous joy. We
and
have
more
a
fantastical
little,
it is.
Yeah, we have a little nature reserve, and Jonathan, my husband, is out there, and he teaches young people about nature, and we have the most wonderful life because of that place, and things happen, and it is astonishing. So it's not all gloom and doom, but I think one needs to understand where the problems are. So, okay, I'm going to read this. Close Encounters. I am waiting for Jonathan. He should have been home by now. I crane my neck over the hedge to see if he's coming down the path, but no sign. He was late taking the dogs for a walk, so he decided to do the round, along the meadow, over the bridge, up the hill, and then down the track behind the house. But now it's getting dark. Where is he? He is standing halfway up the hill with a barn owl on his head. He was watching her noiseless reconnaissance along the hedgerow over the blackthorn, hovering for a moment, wings quivering above her like a warrior headdress, her searchlight eyes and ears sweeping the sward. She was out early, so must have had chicks to feed. He stood still as the dogs went on ahead. Then she landed on a post 30 meters away. She was watching the dogs. Jonathan remained motionless. The dogs, no doubt wondering what was keeping him, turned around to come back up the path in the direction of the owl. As they approached, she stood up on the post, then lifted off to fly away from them, towards Jonathan. The owl was flying at almost head height straight for him. He held his breath, riveted. He could see her glowing face, almost human, her round black eyes in the heart-shaped ghostly whiteness, her short, sharp beak, the tiny diamonds trapped in her caramel wing feathers. Just inches away, she rose above him and dropped her feet to land, softly, weightlessly, on his head. So there he is, with an owl on his head, standing in the middle of the track, silhouetted against the darkening amethyst sky. The owl turns round to face the direction of the dogs. Her claws are sharp as pins. He feels the warmth of her body through her plumage as she sits down. The dogs stop to look up at Jonathan with an owl on his head. Disconcerted, their ears twitching back and forwards. And there he stays, completely still, thinking, I have an owl on my head. I have an owl on my head. And the owl watches the dogs, and the dogs watch the owl, and everyone stays like that for what is probably minutes, but seems so much longer, which is when I am wondering what on earth he is doing, when he is doing nothing but feeling everything. Human and wild thing joined in a fleeting silvered moment in the twilight hour. Nothing to her, but branded sharp as her pin claws into his memory. Jonathan remains, the violet sky deepening, the dogs in the middle ground looking up at the man and the owl in this four-way silent conversation, until finally, finally, he tips his head slowly to the side and the owl flies off, thinking whatever an owl thinks when her post suddenly walks away. There we go.
You see, isn't that just a beautiful scene and beautifully written? And if you like that, you'll like the whole book. That's all I can say. It's a wonder, Keggy. It's a fabulous book. It really is. And as I said, everyone on the planet should read it.
Well, it's for animals. It really is for our animal relatives. So there we go.
Are there any questions? Yes, Annabelle.
Hey.
What is the answer, Keggy?
Oh God.
I think you should take the mic because people at the back won't hear you. Take the mic, Annabelle. Oh, yeah.
Should we be going vegan, or is that just going to create another whole host of problems with, you know, monocultures of coconut palms and so on? My son's gone vegan, and there's a lot of pressure on the rest of us to follow suit, but I'm not sure if it's the right way to go.
Well, vegans, I'm in great admiration of vegans. I mean, I write in the book rather glibly that when I was a child, when I was young, vegans were Americans, were only Americans, and they looked like they weren't going to last very long because that's how we thought about them. They're brilliant people. I'm not a vegan and I'm not a vegetarian. So but we know where our meat is from. So we spend much more on our meat and we eat much less. We do enjoy it, but for me, and I'm not lecturing anybody here. I'm really, really not. And I also say in the book that I feel that my position is probably full of hypocrisy. But for me, a life has to be worth living. A life has to be worth living. So if it's not worth living, I don't want anything to do with it. And if there's any cruelty involved, I don't want anything to do with it. So there is an ecological case for grazing. We need grazers. We need herbivores. We need those creatures to do the jobs to create. We don't have swallows. If we don't, I mean, a lot of our cows have gone and we've lost a lot of the swallows. It's all connected. We're all interconnected. We all need other species to survive, and we do eat each other. But we know better not to be to create absolute hellholes for animals. And we really, Noah Harari. That's right. So he's an Israeli historian, as we all know, wrote the big book Sapiens, and now he thinks the greatest crime of humanity is industrial farming, and I think he's right. Yeah,
what? Yeah, yeah, I'm fishing. It's the same thing.
Industrial farming is fishing. Fishing, that is fishing without taking, putting anything back. So it's the same. It's okay. It's not farming, but it is fishing. And Jonathan is always reminding me, don't forget the seas, because the seas are the massively important. Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, if you don't have animals, then you just have crops. And if you look at the
you can't have crops without animals.
And if you look at the we're on the Jowett's land here, and they're incredible conservationists. And there's a meadow beyond Middledown, which is this one, the coombe that runs just at the end of the Fishery Festival site. And on the top of that, and a meadow beyond, up near a place called Rat's Castle, where they've put in lots of extra wildflowers, and they have grazing on it. And the wildflowers obviously attract more insects, and therefore more birds. And they don't put tractors on it, so the soil isn't as compounded. So there's more worms, and the soil is more aerated. Then the sheep come on it and munch it all and poo all over the place. And actually, they've seen a rise in the soil level. Whereas on the other side of the valley, on a part of land which is directly opposite, which is just arable farmed and absolutely sprayed every year with all kind of horrible stuff, the layer has gone lower. And if you look above on the field at the top, above your field that runs up to the track, and look how much lower that field is to the track. And that is soil erosion. That's what happens if you have just arable.
Well, and we've also got some weird, weird modern problems like tidy. I mean, it's a disaster. The strimming and the hedge management that goes on at the moment, it's just everything is cut down. You can't have moths laying eggs on the tips of branches. It's every year. It's smashed by the hedge flailers, and it costs money. I mean, what on earth and why? So much that we do doesn't need to be done, and so much costs money. And so much good could be done if we just stop it. Just stop. And just go back to loving things that are a little bit loose, and let the Chinese have this thing called Wu Wei, and it's just let the bamboos sway. Let's let the bloody bamboos sway a bit. You know, who wants to see a verge just chopped and then see all the rubbish that we've thrown in it? You know, I don't. I'd rather see... Yeah, we used to have glowworms up our lane. So we just need to loosen up a bit as well. More chemicals are sold to gardens at the moment. You know, I mean, it's just crazy.
Any other questions?
Sorry. Yeah, any other questions? So they're terrified now.
They have got a little bit better. They've got a little bit better around here about cutting verges on the road.
A bit better. Not brilliant. A bit better.
Yes, right at the back.
I am absolutely brilliant talk, and I've sort of been missold this. I thought it would be about dogs. About dogs. And that. Anyway. I live near Wareham Forest. I don't know if you know it very well.
Yes, I do, yeah.
And the growth in there is absolutely incredible, and the wildlife. I don't know how much you know about that and what you think about that. Because you actually get people moaning about it, that it's all overgrown.
I mean, it's a problem, people moaning about it, you know. I mean, we have problems. I mean, I never know quite how to behave because I'm the sort of mad woman at the end of the lane trying to sort of protect, you know, the wild bit of little London. It's wonderful when people cop on to how fabulous it is, because then they start seeing the most amazing insects that they haven't seen for years, and nature comes back. And I don't understand this tidy thing, because in our, you know, if you look at the gift cards you're going to buy your mum for Christmas, you're not going to buy her a picture of a strimmed plastic lawn, are you? You're going to buy the hollyhocks and all the bees and the stuff around the front window and the door, and it all overgrown and gorgeous. Why? What's going on? So why do you want to, you know, create this sort of weird home that's not all... You know, we chop down a bush, right, to get the view. That's somebody's home. It's like 50 sparrows lived in that before. So that's what I want to do. It's like, oh, okay, so it's a little bit darker, but the joy of the sparrows is great. So you just have to keep talking about your excitement in Wareham Forest.
Well, I've got to say that...
I didn't answer the question. I'm sorry for that, but I'm well known for not answering the question.
Well, I'm going to conclude, and my conclusion is this, that while the book is horrifying in many ways, it also does come with lots of hope. And if anyone who reads it can suddenly find a greater love for the environment we live in and a greater enchantment in this incredible world, then that's a good thing.
Yeah.
And what you've done is an amazing book, Keggy. It's a really, really
Thank
amazing
you.
Book. I really
Thank
honestly
you.
Think that. And
Thank you.
I hope you all go and buy it if you haven't already. And Keggy, you will be signing books, won't you,
yeah.
in Waterstones afterwards.
Thank you, Jamie. Thank you.
Keggy, thank you very much. Well done.